Call from mom. Answer it. Call silenced.
Instacart knows nothing gets between you and the game. That's why they make ordering from your couch easy. Stock up today and get all your groceries for the week delivered in as fast as 30 minutes without missing a minute of the game.
You have 47 new voicemails.
Download the app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
Hi, I'm Lauren Sherman, the host of Fashion People. I love fashion, obviously, but shopping for fashion online is kind of annoying. There's endless scrolling, my size is always out of stock, and I can't actually find what I want. No one has really made this work for me. That is until List. Instead of browsing different stores one by one, on List you can see and shop all of the best fashion. List is the secret shopping weapon now used by all my most stylish, cool, and in-the-know friends. Don't shop around. Join 200 million fashion shoppers, including me, on List.com. That's L-Y-S-T. Or download the List app on the App Store today.
Good morning. Happy Sunday. It is Hardline here on News Radio 930 WBEN. Joe Beamer and Brenda Alesi. Brenda is off recovering, and we hope she is back here as soon as possible. We've got a stacked show for you today, so let's kick it off. Our first guest is former Erie County executive and current New York State gubernatorial candidate, Joel Giambra. Joel, good morning.
Hi, Joe. How are you?
I'm doing all right. Long time no talk.
I know.
Last week, we talked with Lee Zeldin, who is also putting his hat in for the Republican nomination. So, Joel, you're looking at this. I believe it's your second time looking at the governor's mansion. What is it in New York State that makes you want to run?
Well, Joe, obviously, I'm tired of the progressive democracy that we've seen during this last budget deliberation, where, you know, taxes were raised over $4 billion, new programs were established, monies for undocumented immigrants, where we have people who came here legally who are still waiting for their unemployment. I have been trying to convince the Republican leadership for a number of years that we need to change the playbook. I mean, we haven't elected a Republican statewide since George Pataki and Dennis Vacco. So the playbook that we've been using, from my perspective, is antiquated, and we need a new playbook. And what I have suggested is something that, unfortunately, some people in the Republican leadership have reacted as revolutionary, and I think it's evolutionary. What I'm suggesting is that the best way to find the most appropriate candidate to beat the Democrat in November of next year is to have a Republican open primary and open the voting process to non-affiliated voters. Right now in New York State, Joe, Democrats represent 50% of the electorate. Republicans represent 22%, and unaffiliated blank voters are 23%. So we've now seen a situation where unaffiliated voters exceed Republican voters. So by opening up the Republican primary to the unaffiliated voters, will give us a better idea who the strongest, who the most effective and appropriate candidate is to face whomever the Democrat is next year.
So, Joel, you're not saying open it up to everyone. You're saying open it up to Republicans plus those who do not belong to a party. So it wouldn't be like Democrats could vote in the Republican primary, correct?
Correct. This is a modified version of some of the primaries that take place across the country. And this will prevent the Democratic Party, if you will, from infiltrating, as some of the leaders in the Republican Party have been concerned about. So by limiting just to unaffiliated voters, most of them probably are former Republican and Democratic voters who have decided, for whatever reason, they were disenchanted with either party. So in order for the Republican Party to increase its ranks is to find a candidate who could be supported by that group, that constituency. Because when the Democrats far outnumber Republicans, if the Republican candidate, Joe, is unable to attract Democrats and unaffiliated voters, they can't win. that's what I'm saying. If we want to win, we have to change the playbook.
And you cited in your letter to Nick Langworthy what happened with the Republican Party of Connecticut. So for the Republican Party to do this, they wouldn't have to take the state to court, right? They have every legal right to open the primary to who they want to open the primary to.
Correct. The legal research I've done, because of the Connecticut case, the precedent has been established that the Republican Party in New York State would only need to change its bylaws. Doesn't have to go to court, doesn't have to have an act of Congress or the state legislature. All it requires is the political will to change course and to do something different, which might change the outcome.
Now, in this letter, you also said, and you just said it a few minutes ago, about the candidate or the party either being too far to the right. That's also something you said in 2018. Do you think the Republican Party, I know this is a chance for them to do it, do you think they will pick someone or go more to the middle? Because as we've seen in New York State, the further right you are, the least chance you have to win a statewide election.
Right, so as you say, we have to realize we are not in Alabama. We are not in Texas. This is a very blue Democratic state. And we have to find a candidate who appeals to the masses. And, you know, because of Andrew Cuomo's problems, they've left us an opportunity, the Republican Party an opportunity, to do something we haven't done since the late 70s, elect a Republican statewide. But we're going to... negate the opportunity by running a candidate who's to the right, very conservative, who has the support of the Conservative Party, which to me has been a hindrance to the Republican Party for a long time. And to, again, find that candidate who best represents the independents and the blanks if we're going to succeed. Cuomo, nobody knows whether he's going to run or not. I personally think that unless he gets charged with a crime, he's going to run for office.
Do you think the Republican Party's chances are better with Governor Cuomo, or do you think if it's that moderate, if it is you running as the Republican Party, regardless who they put, the Republicans have a better chance because they haven't gone far to the right?
So I think we have to stay away from being a far-right party. We need to come back to being a party of being fiscally conservative. I think we need to be a party that is socially tolerant of other people and their lifestyles. And I also think we need to shed this identity of being a Trump party. Being a Trump party in New York State is a prescription for disaster. The president, unfortunately, has a very, very negative opinion of all the voters in New York State, even among Republicans, Joe. I've seen recent polling where Republicans have even started to leave the Trump column after the January 6th insurgents. So we've got to realize that we can no longer be a party that's attached to the personality of Donald Trump, but we need to be a party that stands for principles and policy change.
Before we talk about that policy, I do want to ask one question off of that. Do you think more people in the Republican Party want to separate themselves from Donald Trump, but don't do so out of fear more than loyalty?
Well, there is obviously fear. I mean, Donald Trump, let's face it, much like Andrew Cuomo, is a bully. And, there are people who are fearful of him and his money. He was able to raise, vast amounts of money between leaving the White House and today for various reasons. So there are a lot of people in the Republican Party who are afraid that he will be vindictive and use that money to hurt Republican candidates in a Republican primary. I think it's time to stop being afraid. It's time to fight fire with fire and talk about issues and policy change and the problems facing New York State and the exodus of people and the high taxes. That's going to get the voters' attention, not whether you support or not support Donald Trump.
And speaking of those issues, the first one that comes to mind, Joel, is last time in 2018, you did bring up a marijuana legalization plan. Well, now we've seen in Albany a marijuana legalization plan. What do you think of the current plan in Albany? Where did it go right and where did it go wrong?
Well, it's long overdue. I've been talking about this for over 20 years, the whole issue of prohibition, and that prohibition doesn't work. We've known that's a failed public policy. I think the bill that they passed has some very serious flaws. I'm concerned that the price of adult use of marijuana through the legalized process is going to be so much higher than the price in the black market that we will have defeated some of the purpose, which was to eliminate the black market and take this product away from young children who are getting it from street dealers who don't check ID and don't check proof. So price is a very important piece of whether or not we're going to be successful in eliminating the black market and having better control over who gets marijuana and who doesn't.
And that price has a lot to do with the high tax they would put on marijuana, correct?
Well, right now, as I can tell, there's a 13% new tax on marijuana, and then the existing 8% tax, and then you're going to have an additional tax based on the amount of THC in the product. And then there probably will be other regulations that will drive the cost up. So, you know, it'll be interesting to see what the final regulations that are promulgated and the effect it's going to have on the price of legalized adult use marijuana.
And speaking of tax, Joel, you know, we've seen, especially the last year, but it didn't just start with COVID. We've seen a lot of people leaving New York State, and the number one reason is not the weather. It's the high taxes. So how do we start to tackle the high taxes while we have an unrealistic budget in Albany?
Well, Joe, again, the budget that was passed this last time is unsustainable. We had this one-time largesse from the federal government. All of that was spent and then some. An additional $4 billion of new taxes is going to drive more people out of New York State. When you look at the combined tax obligation for state and local taxes in New York State on a per capita basis, we are either first or second in the nation on what we charge people to live and do business in New York State. So as long as that's the case, we will not be able to return the Empire State to greatness. And how do you reduce expenses? It's not rocket science. All right. First of all, you have to have the political courage to do it. And secondly, you have to look at all of the redundant, inefficient levels of government and governance that we have in New York State. One example, every year we, the state legislature and the governor, put $1 billion plus more into education funding. And it's ironic that we keep putting more money into the system and the test scores are going down. And at the same time, we still have about, if I'm not mistaken, 635 school districts in New York State. You know, why 635? There's some number between 1 and 635 that makes more sense. And if we can get to a point where we can consolidate and merge school districts, there will be billions of dollars of administrative saving. That's just one example. And there are hundreds of those similar type examples where we can reduce spending by making government work better, smarter, and cheaper.
Joel, talking about district consolidation, do you think a plan of having one district per county or two districts per county is more of the way to go in New York State?
Well, Joe, just use Erie County as an example. We have 29 separate school districts in Erie County. Now, I don't know if one is the right number, but I certainly know that there's some number between 1 and 29 that makes more sense. Maybe it's 4, maybe it's 5. And we have to do a little bit more analysis. But New York City has one school district, and they have, you know, 8 million people living in New York City. So, you know, this situation where we have this antiquated system of dividing communities based on geographic boundaries in school districts doesn't make sense to me anymore.
And, you know, during the election, COVID will obviously still be something people talk about. And I'm going to phrase the question this way. What would you say to New Yorkers? Because I feel once we do get back to normal, everyone's going to have in the back of their mind, all it's going to take is an outbreak and I'll lose my business again. I'll be stuck at home again. So what's the message to New Yorkers so they can go about their day without that fear that another outbreak can lock them down again?
Well, I think we all have to be, continue to be vigilant, Joe. And we have to, you know, understand what the CDC is telling us, what the NIH is telling us, and to follow those protocols as best we can. You know, I have been paying very much attention to this because of my recent kidney transplant and my immune system. So I obviously have to be a lot more careful than maybe the average person. But we all have to do our part. And if we all do our part, I think we'll get through this and we'll be able to get the economy up and running again.
All right, Joel, I ended my interview with Lee Zeldin this way. I will do it the same with you. What is the message to the voters? What's the last thing you want to say before we wrap this up?
Well, the message is change should not be viewed as revolutionary. It should be viewed as evolutionary. And if we want to win, Republicans, if they want to win a statewide election, you have to change the playbook. Because if we do it the same way, as Albert Einstein said, if you do things the same way and you expect a different result, it's insanity. Let's not be insane. Let's change the playbook and find the right candidate.
Well, Joel, it was great to hear from you. Hopefully we are talking to you again very soon.
Thank you, Joe. Have a great day.
Thank you. Joel Giambra running for that GOP New York State governor plan. And tell me what you think. 803-0930 on the Volkswagen of Orchard Park text board, opening that primary to more than just the 22% of the state that's registered as Republican. When we come back, guess what? School zone cameras. Yes, they are back in the news, or still in the news. I'm not sure they actually ever left. Councilmember Rashid Wyatt is here. He had a proposal that passed in the Common Council, but now it's in limbo. And those cameras are still on. We're talking about that next here on Hardline. Welcome back.
Worried about letting someone else pick out the perfect avocado for your perfect impress them on the third date guacamole? Well, good thing Instacart shoppers are as picky as you are. They find ripe avocados like it's their guac on the line. They are milk expiration date detectives. They bag eggs like the 12 precious pieces of cargo they are. So let Instacart shoppers overthink your groceries so that you can overthink what you'll wear on that third date. Download the Instacart app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
Hi, I'm Lauren Sherman, the host of Fashion People. I love fashion, obviously, but shopping for fashion online is kind of annoying. There's endless scrolling, my size is always out of stock, and I can't actually find what I want. No one has really made this work for me. That is until List. Instead of browsing different stores one by one, on List you can see and shop all of the best fashion. List is the secret shopping weapon now used by all my most stylish, cool, and in-the-know friends. Don't shop around. Join 200 million fashion shoppers, including me, on List.com. That's L-Y-S-T. Or download the List app on the App Store today.
Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage, to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Shopify is here to help you grow. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell everywhere. From their all-in-one e-commerce platform to their in-person POS system, wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 15% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. And sell more with less effort thanks to Shopify Magic, your AI-powered all-star. Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the U.S. And Shopify is the global force behind Allbirds, Rothy's, and Brooklinen, and millions of other entrepreneurs of every size across 175 countries. Plus, Shopify's award-winning 24/7 help is there to support your success every step of the way. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/odysseypodcast, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/odysseypodcast now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. shopify.com/odysseypodcast.
Hardline here on News Radio 930 WBEN. Last week, the Buffalo Common Council voted 6-3 to end the program. But as we sit here right now, the program has not ended. The person who introduced that resolution, Councilmember Rashid Wyatt, joining us from the University District. Councilmember, good morning.
Good morning, Joe.
So give us an update. We're still talking about the cameras. Now, it passed, your resolution passed to end the program. What exactly was your resolution?
Well, the resolution was to eliminate, remove the cameras and put non-punitive means in place, meaning speed humps, have beacons, crosswalks, all those things that we normally should have or we could put in place to keep our children safe and not to be giving people who live in one of the poorest cities in the nation $50 fines in the midst of a pandemic.
And as of now, that resolution, not only has it not been signed by the mayor, but at last I heard, it hasn't even reached the mayor's desk?
Well, he can refuse it all he wants. It was submitted to him, and he has 10 days to do something on it. And if he doesn't, that's his choice, but then it goes into effect. He wants to say that the attorneys have told him that something wasn't done appropriately. Well, fortunately for us, we do have an attorney on our staff, and he gave us some advice. And we also seeked out opinions from others who know this type of law, and they all feel we're on solid footing. So he's the only one in the room that feels like we did something wrong.
And so before it's signed, so even though it passed the council, if you go over the speed limit, you get caught on that camera, it is still giving fines out as of right now?
Yes. And to be quite honest, that will still take place for a number of months. But the one thing that we looked at, we tried to get this passed early on so the administration can put those other non-punitive measures in place before for the fall, before school starts in September. So we were trying to be as responsible as we can. The administration is going to also have to inform the vendor that their service will no longer be needed. So they'll have an opportunity to give them the 60-day notice that's appropriate. So we've done all that we can. It's just the mayor wants to continue to drag his feet on this issue when it's so very, very, very unpopular. And I just can't imagine that he would keep trying to fight this when we can do this another way, and it could be more effective because the speed humps are there 24/7. It's not a point in time when people will get tickets, but it could be an opportunity for people just to be responsible and drive not only during school hours, but even after hours when people are still walking in our neighborhoods.
Now, you said in 10 days, if the mayor doesn't sign it, it does go into effect. Does that mean the other parts of the resolution, like the speed humps, would start going into effect? Those construction plans would be in place to get those speed humps in those areas?
Well, the legislation is asking that. And again, it's up to the administration once we pass this law to put it in effect. In my capital budget, I've already asked for speed humps. So I'm expecting speed humps to be everywhere in the university district. But this particular plan dealing with the 20 cameras that are currently in effect, we're asking for in those areas to make certain that we have speed humps and other measures to make sure our children stay safe.
Now, you said you would give a 60-day notice to the company that takes care of these cameras. Would there also be another charge from that company to end the program that the city would be looking at?
No, we can cancel the program with 60 days notice without having an additional charge. That's the contract. So we hope that the city will take advantage of that and make certain that there are no further charges or any lawsuits against us because we're giving them advance notice. And it's at the end of a school year. And unfortunately, our children weren't even in school. But for people who were getting these tickets, you would think that we had a whole schools full of students, and that wasn't the case all year long. So we need to end this program so that people can stop getting $50 fines.
Now, I got to ask you, as you said, it would end if the mayor doesn't sign it, or if he does, the resolution passed. It passed 6-3 in the council. Do you think once that 10 days passes, it's the end we'll hear of these cameras? Or do you think the mayor plus the three that did not vote for the resolution are going to try to push this, try to keep these cameras in effect? Or do you think, even though the mayor's dragging his feet, even though it hasn't been signed, these cameras are coming to an end?
Yeah, I think these cameras are coming to an end. I think the mayor is going to continue to fight this issue. Unfortunately, even though the people in our community, the city of Buffalo, and even in the outskirts have said that it was a bad program, it's poorly ran, and it's just time to put an end to it. And when there's other means, I guess I'm just flabbergasted that he's fighting so hard against this program when there are other reasonable methods to put in place that don't penalize people. He supported the Fair Fines and Fees group, reducing fines and those things. And here we are putting another fine in place of the fines that he reduced. So it's just not a good look. And again, it just kind of, to me, insult to injury that people in the midst of a pandemic still have to deal with $50 fines when our schools aren't even fully at capacity right now.
It is interesting that we've been talking about this with half empty schools and, as you said, a pandemic where a lot of people haven't even gotten back to work yet. Speaking of the pandemic, council member, I'd like to know, you know, we're hearing a lot about COVID vaccine hesitancy, and I want to know if you've seen that in your district.
I guess I have, but I do know that there are people who were hesitant to who are now coming around seeing that this is an opportunity for them to get back to normal. And I'm just encouraging people, get the vaccine. I know the hesitancy, but it can save lives. And if you, and I mean, it doesn't stop you from getting the infection, but it will make it less severe. And that's important. So I want to get that message out to the citizens in the university district that if you have been hesitant, you know, please rethink it, because we know that those numbers continue to go up. If the people continue to die from this this deadly virus.
And how have you seen the vaccine rollouts throughout the city? Have they been pretty well organized and getting people right in and right out?
Yeah, I mean, a couple of weeks ago I got my vaccine, and it ran pretty well, and I'm very happy that it seems to be going in all the areas in which there were concerns before. So I'm really happy that we seem to be right on track. And being available to people who may not have transportation.
Now, I want to ask you this, and this might be a loaded question that you don't have an opinion on, and that is fine, but we did hear from the county executive about the stadium and the arena, which obviously are owned by the county, but the ballpark downtown being owned by the city. Would you, if the Blue Jays do come to town, which is still just a rumor, if the Blue Jays do come to town this summer, would you support something like Mark Poloncarz's plan to have vaccinated passes so you could get more people into the ballpark to see the Blue Jays this summer?
You know what? Honestly, whatever measures that we can take to get people more inclined to get vaccinated, I'm willing to do. And if that's what it takes, absolutely. Because we really want to eradicate this virus, and we can't do so if we still have a population of people who are still susceptible to getting the infection. And so if that's a means to get people more vaccinated, I'm definitely supportive of it.
You know, I've heard this a lot, speaking of the vaccine. I've heard a lot of people say, well, you know, at a certain point, we are going to have to say everyone's had the chance of the vaccine. The people who didn't get it are going to have to assume the risk. We have to get back to normal. What's your opinion on there? Is there a month? Is there a time where we say we've had the vaccines open to everyone? We have to start getting back to normal?
I just think that we have to continue the effort to getting everyone vaccinated. I don't think we can pause it. I don't think we can stop it. I don't think that we can just sit back and say, okay, we got enough people vaccinated, because it's still dangerous. And the variant that they keep speaking of can continue to thrive. So I don't think that we can pause this. I think this is still very, very dangerous as we see the numbers in Erie County continue to go up. I think that we must still keep a full court press on this process and making certain that everyone that we can get vaccinated gets vaccinated. I don't think we can ever close the door on it, because from what Dr. Fauci and the experts are saying, this still is dangerous and it can flare up anywhere. And because we don't know all the details about how long this vaccine will last, I think there's too many unknowns right now for us to back off. I think we have to go as far as we can to get as many people vaccinated as we can.
All right, council member. I just have one more question. You know, nationwide with the result of the Derek Chauvin trial on Tuesday, police reform is back in the news. And I just want to know your thoughts on the Buffalo police reform. How's that going? And how much further do you think the Buffalo police have to get those reform measures that we've seen throughout the country?
Well, we have a long way to go on that. Let me just tell you. The council passed something that the mayor had put forth. There were a number of council members that didn't agree with it. I don't think it went far enough. I think that we have to have more public conversation. The city of Buffalo had 5 conversations. Albany had 60. I think that shows a tremendous disparity. It seems as though we don't really have a great interest in reform. But I'm so proud to say that our New York State Attorney General sent us a letter and talked about how inadequate our proposal was. And so I'm excited about the opportunity to restart this conversation and to do it the right way. I think the Chauvin trial and these other shootings that have happened afterwards cause for us to take advantage of this day. This is a significant opportunity. It may not come around again for another 100 years. And now that the Congress is looking at the George Floyd police reforms, we must take full advantage of it. And again, this is not anti-police. This is for police. This is to make certain that they have every tool that they need, but also an opportunity for us to engage the citizens. We can't have citizens against police and police against citizens. We all have to be on the same page because this is the United States of America. So I'm looking forward to those conversations, and I think those advocates who have stood out there and protested peacefully for their efforts, because we want to make certain that this United States serves every single citizen, Blacks, Asians, Hispanics, every group, whites, everybody. And I think, again, working together works.
Councilmember Rashid Wyatt, thank you so much for joining me this morning.
Thank you.
That is University District Councilmember Rashid Wyatt joining me. It is Hardline with Joe Beamer and Brenda Alacy. Brenda, still recovering here on WBEN. Welcome back. It is Hardline on News Radio 930 WBEN. We talked about it with Councilmember Rashid Wyatt. Here is Susan and Brian talking to Brad Garrett about the outcome of the Chauvin trial and police reform around the United States of America.
Brad Garrett, crime and terrorism analyst, is our guest right now after the Chauvin verdict, and kind of time to assess what happens next. You know, Brad, this is treated as kind of this landmark decision, you know, a moment in history by a lot of people. And then you have people like I'm accused of being sometimes the skeptic who says, what really changes going forward? Initially, looking at this, what does this tell you about what changes there might be in terms of policing, in terms of how officers are held accountable for use of force going forward?
So, Brian, I don't think that just the conviction of Derek Chauvin or really have much impact on officers using excessive force and or deadly force. I mean, there are things that just have to change within departments. For example, accountability. If you look at officers that end up in situations, and, you know, let's face it, the Derek Chauvin case is so egregious and, you know, so over the top in even the idea that you would use any form of excessive or deadly force. So you sort of have to set it aside and say, okay, the everyday officer that gets into situations where they may be forced to use deadly force and it's clear they had no option to, well, were there other options? And so when you look at people like Chauvin and other officers, many of them have track records of excessive force complaints. How accountable have they been held to those complaints? Either by the police department and or whether the police union and the contract that the police union have with the police department, whether they're allowed to discipline in a certain way or keep track of excessive force and really sort of proactively deal with officers that have problems. And that's one side of it. You know, there's a very long list of what can potentially be done to reduce excessive force. But I think this is one of the bigger ones is accountability and perhaps the relationship or the limitations that contracts via police unions place on police departments.
We talked, Brad, with the chairman of the Buffalo Police Oversight Committee this morning, who mentioned a list of things that have really been implemented in the past year in Buffalo and things that they're considering. But he said de-escalation training is at the top of the list. How do you teach de-escalation techniques?
Well, they're fairly easy to teach. They're much more difficult to get people to implement them. You know, police historically t- tend not to follow training to the extent that you would like them to, that they learn a certain way to do things and they continue to do them despite the training. There's more than one study that supports what I'm about to say, that police officers who tend to use excessive force in situations where it's not necessary, then the people they work with end up doing the same thing. In other words, the incident of excessive force by officers working with officers who have a history of excessive force, it breeds on each other. And so I'm only using that as an example of these are things you have to address early on in a police officer's career. And because of barriers, obstacles, and sometimes the personality of the officer themselves makes it a real challenge.
We're at the same time that the verdict came down on Tuesday, we hear about this incident over in Columbus, Ohio, that although it appears to be so drastically different than what happened in Derek Chauvin's case, for a lot of people, it's almost lumped into the same category. I mean, for all appearances, and we don't know, you know, if there was another use of force that was available at the time, but from everything you see in this video, a police officer stops somebody from, you know, really wounding another person with a knife in, you know, a kind of a split second decision. Is there a way to stop every use of force from a police officer from kind of falling into that same discussion, or is there no room for nuance anymore in, you know, any of our discussions?
Well, I do think there's room for discussion. I think that the hostility toward law enforcement that then translates into the officers feeling frustrated, isolated, them against us, doesn't help, because that raises the temperature, obviously, and their anger and rage potentially toward a particular community. So, yes, you can people, as I mentioned earlier, de-escalation skills, you can hold them more accountable, but you also have to make law enforcement more appealing to people who want to be police officers. We're in a real dilemma in this country in getting people to want to be police officers, mainly because of what the three of us are talking about. Others is that they feel like that the system won't back them up if something bad happens, and that's also driving people away. There's a balance to all of these things, but we clearly have not gotten to that point yet.
What has been the impact of body cams in this?
You know, what's interesting, Susan, is that the studies of body cams basically say it has no effect on officers' behavior. I mean, let's face it, in the last year, how many videos have we all seen of police shootings, use of excessive force, that were caught on body cameras? And so that does not appear to be effective as far as if you're trying to reduce excessive or deadly force. I will tell you, though, that by and large, body cameras are extremely helpful in prosecuting people, because it lays out obviously what the officer's doing, but it clearly lays out what the suspect is doing. And so it cuts both ways, but it tends to go more toward what prosecutors can use in a trial.
Brad, thank you. That's Brad Garrett, crime and terrorism analyst, joining us live this morning.
And when we come back, we are speaking with Mike Cornell. He is the superintendent at Hamburg Schools, but also the president of the Erie Niagara Superintendent Association. It is Hardline on WBEN.